Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Kathleen Sebelius Show, our salute to departing Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius.
Boy, that was quick. How long was she in?
You don't 5 years.
Well, that was quick.
Yeah. No, she was actually, for a Health and Human Services Secretary, she lasted through the first term, and she lasted through healthcare.gov. Now, you can say she lasted
No, healthcare.gov is what got her out,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she lasted through the launch of that, and then it has been basically an exit strategy, in our opinion, pretty much since then. With me from the University of Kentucky to talk about our online presence, our healthcare.gov site, is techno guru, communications guru, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org. They're there. They're in MP3 format. Download them. Listen to them. If you thought you heard us say something but went, whoa, what'd they just say? And you need to listen to it again, WMKY.org. Now, it will take about 4 days after the live broadcast on Saturday mornings to get out there. So you're looking at about Tuesday before it shows up. But it is there. You can go download it. And if you want to have it sent to you automatically, just go to iTunes or whatever system you use for your podcast and subscribe to our podcast. And if you don't know what that is, I suggest Wikipedia. That'll help you a lot. After you've listened to the show and you want to interact with the show, go to Facebook.com, do a search for HM Radio Show. There you will find a page, a fan page for Health Matters. We don't like to call it a fan page because really, it's really more informative and it's your way to interact with the show. Drop us a comment, some feedback. Let us know if there's any particular show topics you might be interested in. We'll certainly post some relevant research that makes it to the show. We'll post noteworthy news with medical topics. Sometimes we go non-medical. You just never know what you're going to expect on Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Tick Fixers, and their top six quick tick fixing tricks, reminding you ticks can't compete when you use DEET. That's right, DEET. Not at all natural in any way, but it is a great chemical to use to keep the ticks from biting in. We've got our top six quick tick fixing tricks from the Tick Fixers. Trick number one, avoid tick bites is the key. They mention wearing long pants and tuck the pant legs into your socks. Boy, that is a look. I have tried that around campus, and the chicks love it. Can I just say that?
Well, I mean, it's very humorous, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you walk by, they laugh.
Yeah. Well, one thing I did do, I finally decided it is not good to have open or baggy pant legs. And I've got some rubber bands that I keep in my tractor toolbox. And when I'm going to go out in the woods, I will rubber band the lower end of my pants. But I just can't quite tuck them into the socks. That just seems a little strange to me. Inspect your skin, especially armpit and groin areas, immediately after outdoor activities. And if skin exposure is unavoidable, use DEET. You can use 10 to 35% DEET. That's adequate in most circumstances. 10% effective for 2 hours. 25% about 5 hours of protection. Again, depending on whether you're swimming or sweating, it may be shorter than that. Permethrin is another. It's called Permanone is the brand name. It is another pesticide excellent for clothing. It will last through several washes, and you can buy that at a sporting goods store. Tip number two, ticks are best removed as soon as possible. So, again, daily inspections and most of the serious diseases don't start unless the tick is attached for 36 to 48 hours. Reminding you that the goal here is not to punish the tick. Even though you so much want to do that, the goal is to remove the tick intact using a forceps or a pair of tweezers.
The tick intact.
You like that.
The tick intact.
From your toe. That's absolutely right. And you try to keep the whole thing together using tweezers, get close to the skin as possible, and try to remove it. Again, don't try to destroy the tick, burn it, anger it, irritate it.
Once you get it all the way out, why not?
Dismember it. Well, because you're exposed, whatever the tick has, you're exposing yourself to it more.
Really? With fire? If he's a little blue flame, he's going to be dangerous to me?
You've got to hold him to maneuver him over the flame, Rick. We've talked about this. Your goal is not to punish the tick. Your goal is to avoid getting an illness.
Really? But if you use tweezers and do it right, it could seem like torture.
Do you think the tick will repent? Do you think the tick, at some point, the tick says, you know, I should not have bit this guy. I'm going to change my ways and become a vegetarian tick.
Do you know what, Tony? Sometimes in our society, it calls for capital punishment.
So you don't care. You just want this tick to suffer as you have suffered.
Actually, I want it to be fast and quick. I don't want it to suffer.
Once the tick is removed, tip number four, once the tick is removed, wash the bite area with soap or water with an antiseptic to destroy any contaminating microorganisms. Wash your hands as well. Number five, routine antibiotics following a tick removal, particularly in our area of the country, not necessary. May consider it in pregnant persons or people in high-risk areas, and Eastern Kentucky is not one of those. And finally, number six, the size and color of the tick help determine what kind of tick it was. Brown in the size of a pencil point, that's a deer tick. These are tiny ticks. You can barely see them. Sometimes you have a very significant reaction to them. The size of a pencil eraser are the dog ticks. They do not carry Lyme disease, but they can carry other diseases. And a brown to black tick, pencil point size with a splotch on its back, is a Lone Star tick. These are very vicious, aggressive biters, and they can cause a very widespread rash in the area of the bite. That's our sponsor, the Tick Fixers, and their top six quick tick fixing tricks. Remind you, ticks can't compete when you use DEET. It is that time of year. I've already removed two ticks for myself. I've had several of our coworkers.
Was that before or after you were out in the snow?
Oh, yes. We have had a minor spring setback here in the Moorhead area in the form of sub-freezing temperatures and snowfall. But my goodness. You know, it reminds me of those horror movies where you kill the monster and everybody breathes a big sigh of relief and then the monster jumps up for one more battle.
Right.
It's like you have to shoot winter one more time just to make sure it's completely done.
I had an employee. This is funny. I had an employee who took a week off thinking that it was going to be, you know, warmer weather because, you know, all the weather had moved on. And so this was going to be the golf week. And I told him to use an orange golf ball. It'll make it easier to see in the snow.
Well, at least you don't have to battle with other people for tea times.
Exactly. So, yeah, it actually, and I think they said last night here it was supposed to get down around 20 degrees. I don't know that it actually did, but sometimes you just want it to warm up.
We are recording midweek, and so that's why we are mentioning this. No doubt it will have warmed up substantially by Saturday when you hear this program.
We hope.
Yes, and on to our title, our titular article. This is about Kathleen Sebelius. Let me remind you something. First of all, there are local connections. She was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio.
That's kind of local.
Close by. That's right. Her father is Jack Gilligan, the former Democratic governor of Ohio.
And famous boat driver.
Well, obviously, her maiden name was Gilligan, which is a thing to name a young woman. But anyway, because she became the governor of Kansas, they were the first father-daughter governor pair in United States history. She started off in the Kansas House of Representatives in 86, 88, 90, and 92, and then in 94 became state insurance commissioner, a stunning upset. First time a Democrat had won in more than a decade. She did not take campaign contributions from the insurance industry, even though she was the insurance commissioner. She blocked a merger of Blue Cross Blue Shield, and that was the first time that corporation had been blocked in their efforts to acquire subsidiaries. She was governor of Kansas from 2003 to 2009, two-term governor, and their limitations did not allow her to run again. During the 2004 election, she was a potential running mate for John Kerry. In 2005, Time magazine named her as one of the five best governors in America because she eliminated $1.1 billion in debt by ferreting out waste and supporting public education. New York Times also, about that time, named her among the women most likely to become the first female president of the United States. So all is good in the Sebelius-Gilligan family. A meteoric rise, a very strong track record. She is on course to become the next president of the United States. And then she gets the crowning achievement. She is named by President Obama as his nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services. That was in 2009. And she knew darn well that he was running on changing health care. So this was, in fact, the position where she could audition for president of the United States. Unfortunately, that audition
along
did not
comes
go well.
Healthcare.
That's right. Well, and along comes a website called healthcare.gov.
Right.
This is where you're supposed to shop for insurance, and we don't have to belabor this. It was an absolute disaster. And the problem was, as the disaster was dissected, the problem was not so much in the people who wrote the code, the people who actually programmed the site, but it was, in fact, in management, which would fall directly to her.
Right.
There was no management. There was no one in charge of that site. The site was not getting any better. There was no messages coming out. And finally, President Obama actually brought in Jeffrey Zients, who is a management guru, to take over rescuing the website from Kathleen Sebelius. And I think at that point, her political career, I don't know what's going to happen. I know she can do consulting and so forth, but I think her political career was over when someone else was brought in to fix her mess.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what had to happen was a very complex website. Lots of moving parts, it's kind of funny. It summarizes our healthcare system, if you want to know the truth. It's very much like our healthcare system. We have a lot of electronic medical records. They're all different. They all have different data sets. They all have different ways to get in and out. Yes, we've tried to create some protocols to get in and out, but in the end, it's just one big complex beast. And this website kind of mimicked that, and it didn't go well. And I think there was a, you know, one of the things that really hurt this particular project was time. You know, they had to get it implemented so fast that sometimes things that are that complex, you can have teams and teams of programmers working through the night. And it's hard to take a project like that and focus on quality when you're focusing on time. There are driving factors in a project, Tony. I've always been taught that you have quality, you have cost, and you have time. Those are the three things that really drive a project. And no, only one of those things is the trump card. You know, people can say, I want quality and I want cost, but really those two contradict each other. If quality is the number one thing, then you're going to probably throw out cost to some extent. So it's very difficult. And it's clear this website was built on time and not on quality or cost.
Right. But beyond that, the management structure was so flawed. And here's the clue to this. Again, they brought in an outside person who had no knowledge whatsoever of the site just because they needed leadership that she was not supplying. And you can see this because she looks back now and says, well, I knew it was going bad. And how many times have you had an employee, a coworker, a colleague say, oh, I knew that wasn't going to work, and yet the thing proceeded anyway and didn't work? And in that case, I do not respect a person who sees something that's not working and
right.
doesn't make changes. And you note again, they were able to fix her problem really by Christmas
yes.
with different management structure. And so at that point, I realize when someone else comes in and is able to fix something I couldn't fix, I'm really running out of resources.
It's here. A telltale sign that maybe I'm in over my head.
Right. And you can still hear that in the way that she approached it. I will say this, on March 31st, and I'm not a Washington insider by any stretch, but she did tell Huffington Post, I'm in it for the long run. Yes, I'll be here in November. And, oh, I'm in. That was her exact words when asked if she would be there for November. And then 2 weeks later, she announced her resignation. And the New York Times says it was an agreed upon strategy all along that she'd be exiting. And I'm wondering, well, then really, why in the world did she go on TV and say, and you can look this up from the Huffington Post, she actually said, I'm in it till November. So I think there was a distressing lack of knowledge of the situation there, both in terms of building the site and also the repercussions of not being able to finish healthcare.gov. Any way you look at it, this was a major blow to her aspirations, her political career. Speaking of major blows, why don't you take a major blow, take a break, get something to drink. We'll be back for our second fractional portion. We're going to talk about the ways you handle a disaster. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Kathleen Sebelius Show, our requiem, if you will, for former Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. Our sponsor for the second time, the Tick Fixers and their top six quick tick fixing tricks. Remind you, ticks can't compete when you use DEET. That's right, DEET at a 10 to 24% level is plenty enough to give you 2 to 4 hours of protection against ticks. Remember the other things we mentioned, and remember a tick has to bite in for more than 36 hours before the risk of those diseases starts to rise. Now, let's go back to what Rick had said before. Rick wants to punish, to torture the tick, to make sure the tick regrets at any point ever thinking about biting him. Here are, though, the recommended methods of removing a tick. First of all, the don'ts. Do not use sharp forceps. If you puncture this tick, bad things happen. Don't crush, puncture, or squeeze the tick's body. When you do that, the tick acts like a hypodermic syringe and actually injects whatever is in their stomach into you. Don't apply noxious substances, petroleum jelly, gasoline, nail polish. This prolongs your exposure time and gives them a chance to inject their infectious organisms. Ticks have a respiratory rate of 3 breaths per hour. That's right, a tick can go 20 minutes without breathing. Plus, they're attached to your bloodstream, and there's oxygen in there. So you're going to have a tough time suffocating a tick. Don't apply heat with a match or a hot nail. Studies have demonstrated that when you irritate it, that causes it to regurgitate its stomach contents, not what you want. Don't use a twisting or jerking motion. Just pull the tick straight out, and don't handle the tick with your bare hands. How do you remove a tick? Well, first of all, avoid the tick bite. That's best. And again, using these blunt forceps, grab as close as you can to the mouth parts and try to remove the tick in one piece. Then wash the bite area with soap and water or with an antiseptic and wash your hands as well. Do not use routine antibiotics after tick removal. That's our sponsor, the Tick Fixers. And remember, ticks can't compete when you use DEET. And it is, despite the recent snowfall, in fact, tick season here in eastern Kentucky. Several of my coworkers have pulled ticks off them, people who ride horses or people out in the woods. And so it is that time of year again, unfortunately. And this is one thing, Rick. Let's face it, the frigid temperatures we had this winter do not seem to have had any effect whatsoever on the early appearance of ticks. There are at least as many ticks that I am hearing back as last year. Certainly, we do not get any kind of a free pass because it was a cold winter.
Or creepy crawlies in general. I mean, I've seen lots of bees. I've seen lots of pretty much everything, you know, you used to think would get hurt by cold weather, especially. Now, I'm curious to see what this current freeze does, because a lot of times when it warms up and then gets cold, that can be detrimental to the insect population.
But yeah, did a number on our flowers, but I'm, I guess, more pessimistic about the insect population in general and certainly about ticks.
But you have such pretty flowers.
Yeah, but the ticks seem so hardy. They wear their brown coats, and they seem to be able to handle cold better, certainly, than flowers do. Now, as we promised last time, we were talking about Kathleen Sebelius. We feel, personally, that this is either a major roadblock or an end to what was a very promising political career. There is just no way you can spin this, no way that you can say that she was a capable person regarding this healthcare site. She continues to show a lack of understanding, and in fact, people from the outside had to come in and fix it. And this was, like I said, as a governor, apparently she was lights out, elected to two terms, pretty broad base of popular support, and accomplished a lot for her state. So I'm not sure what happened here, but something really bad happened to her career while she was in Washington. Let's talk about managing a disaster, though.
Some like rules. This show?
Well,
we do it every week.
That's right. We've got lots of experience. But Rick, I know you have been, and I'm not casting aspersions on your ability, but you have been involved in some technological failures.
Tony, I mean, you know, I've been 25 years in technology, whether it be healthcare, campus, you know, wherever I've worked as a, to some extent, either a manager of fires or a firefighter directly. And we use that term kind of internally as a joke. We're really, IT guys are really just a bunch of firefighters. You know, we go around putting out fires. But yeah, I mean, you can't be in this business for as long as I have and not have seen some dilemmas.
And likewise, done some quality work for the hospital, also been involved in some patient care things that didn't turn out too well. And so what we did was we took Stephen Brill of Time Magazine had an excellent analysis of how the rescue team managed to get healthcare.gov up and running. I took his three rules, added some additional ones. We came up with our health matters, seven rules for managing a disaster. The first one, and pardon me for going Republican, but both Rudolph Giuliani and Chris Christie did this. You call the family, you call the friends, and you tell them, I'm not coming home. In the case of Superstorm Sandy, in the case of the 9/11 attacks, these men basically stayed on the job until they could see an end to the problems. They made the pain of the survivors their pain, and they stayed with them. And I've seen that actually with the Lexington mayor. This was my understanding. One time there was a big ice storm. It would not allow her electricity to be reconnected until everybody in the city was reconnected. Some of her neighbors, that was rather disturbing because they thought living next to the mayor, you might get some special treatment. In fact, they were without
electricity. It was quite the opposite.
Just the opposite. But the point is, and this happened also with the team that worked on healthcare.gov. They basically came in. They made a trip to buy some additional clothes. Food was brought in. They would run 36, 48-hour marathon sessions. They spent Thanksgiving at Todd Park, who's the chief technology officer. They spent Thanksgiving at his house rather than with their families, and they basically worked on this day and night. Second thing they mentioned, they were surprised when they went in that there was no dashboard. Now, the best way I can tell you a dashboard being a doctor is when I have a very sick patient, I have certain things that I look for every time I see the patient. They're vital signs, we call them, the pulse, the blood pressure, the respiratory rate, the oxygen levels, and so forth. And we may have certain lab tests and so forth, but we have all of those easily displayed so that every time you see the patient, you see this dashboard of how things are doing. And obviously, if the patient's spiking a fever and their blood pressure is going down, things are not going well. Apparently, no one compiled a dashboard for the healthcare.gov website, and so no one knew exactly how fast it was responding or how many people were on or anything else. And you can see that, you know, when people would ask, well, how many people have signed up? I don't know, because they had no dashboard. So one of the first things, they call them tech surge people, did was to develop a dashboard so they could monitor how well the site was working.
Right. Tony, maybe you can do that in the form of, maybe that's what the medical record is for a patient or a patient care type incident like that. But in technology, you know, some of the best and information you get is from the monitoring systems and the forums. Maybe not necessarily dashboards. I think I know what you mean when you say a summary view, kind of a 50,000 foot view is I think what we say. But obviously any data that you can get to help you understand what's going on and where. Maybe it even causes you to ask more questions. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to give you answers as much as it can also give you the ability to ask more questions. We see that all the time where we'll look at a link, say, for example, one of the WAN links go into a small location, and we'll see that link get saturated with traffic. And the monitor doesn't tell you why it's saturating. All it tells you is that it is saturating. And so then it's up to you to go figure out, okay, well, I need to go look at that link, find out what's on it. Then you dig a little deeper, you get a little more data. And then, of course, in the realm that I work in, that's imperative. I mean, you have to have that.
So rule one, you're going to have to put some time on this. Rule two, you're going to have to figure out how you're going to monitor for success or failure.
That's what I would say. I wouldn't necessarily say dashboard as much as I would say you need monitoring tools that tell you real time what's going on.
Health Matters Rule 3, this was posted on the wall at the healthcare.gov site. This is what they said. The war room and meetings are for solving problems. There are plenty of other venues where people devote their creative energies to shifting blame. That is, if you're in the middle of something major, it is not time to figure out whose fault it is. Simply, the only question is, who can help me get out of this problem and work with them? But there is no point in assigning blame in the middle of a disastrous failure.
Well, I mean, Tony, come on. If you take a step back and you think about it, and maybe this is just obvious, but the minute the blame game starts coming out, the person or people or team or group that's getting the blame, all they do is circle wagons and get defensive. And so thus, no information comes out as to what was changed, how it was changed, how it was built, and then it makes the people trying to solve the problem's job exponentially harder. So yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense that you wouldn't want to start blaming. Now, as a manager, you need to document factually what was going on so that in the end, as a technician, I can't expect my people to be blame-free. It's just they have to understand that at that moment in time, there's not going to be a cement block thrown at anybody.
Right.
We still need to get to the root of the problem. And I think if you're managing your people, you know, you can certainly let them understand that sometimes mistakes happen and we'll deal with them as we find out. But certainly in an emergency, you need to fess up. Tell what you did. Can we back it out? Can we make more changes? And in some cases, you may not know you did it, but you still need to be able to tell, well, hey, I did this without fear of retribution.
Right. Rule number four, communication. They held what they called stand-ups, which is everyone stood. No one was allowed to sit, but they had these very brief meetings where they went over the plan for the day. And then at the end of the day, 6:30, 7 o'clock, before they went into their evening work, they would have another stand-up to see how far they gotten along. And Rick, you mentioned communication, obviously a key part of managing any kind of disaster.
Absolutely. I mean, before the show, you know, Tony, you and I were talking and we had another colleague with us talking, and neither of you were doing the same thing that I do from a technical standpoint. We were kind of talking about this. What's the most important thing in a failure event? From the non-technical folks, they start looking at, okay, well, you got to do this, you got to do that. Well, in the technical folks, from my standpoint, the most important thing that I can do is communicate with my user. And I got to let people know what's going on, because an informed user is a less unhappy user, if that makes any sense.
Right. And I got to say, in this case, I felt like Sibelius got sacrificed in that regard. She went on the talk shows to tout the website while someone else was fixing it. And she got skewered in several cases. People said, well, can you tell me how many people are actually signed up? Can you tell me what's happening? And she couldn't.
Right. And that was ultimately the downfall, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the information wasn't flowing. It wasn't that it was inaccurate. It's just it wasn't flowing. And I find in especially at UK, we had an incident a couple of days ago where we had an outage. And the best thing you can do is get it out there and let everybody know it's happening. And that also comforts them to know that you're working on it and that it is an utmost priority for you. So if you can establish those ground rules in a fault event, then it goes a long way to bolstering everybody's confidence that, A, you'll fix it, and B, that it may not happen again.
Fair enough. Number five, this was also posted on the wall at the healthcare.gov site. The ones who should be doing the talking are the people who know the most about an issue, not the ones with the highest rank. If anyone finds themselves sitting passively while managers and executives talk over them, we've gone off rails and we need to correct. I'll go back to the Challenger disaster. The physicist who figured out that there was an O-ring failure was Richard Feynman. And Feynman, while other people were holding hearings with managers, actually went and talked to the engineers. And from there, he was able to deduce that the O-rings were not able to handle the stress. The point is, you need to talk to people who have the most information, not the people who necessarily have the highest title or the highest salary. And I think, again, Rick, that makes perfect sense to me. That's what the healthcare.gov people did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to me, What I want in the form of that is I want information flowing up to me so that I can answer the questions when I'm asked by my peers what's going on. I need to be able to answer those questions. What I don't need to do is go back and make sure that I'm involved in how it's happening. Sometimes the best thing that a manager can do is get the other managers away from the people doing the fixing.
Fair enough.
No, and Tony, it opens up a whole new topic in the fact that how well do people work under pressure? You know, just because there are very, very smart and capable people that just don't do well on tests or they don't do well under pressure. So what does it say when you're on a conference call or a manager or somebody standing right over top of you? Is it fixed yet? Is it fixed yet? What are we doing? Have we tried this? Most of the times, if you have those people that fall into that category that get a little nervous or don't work as well under pressure, you're not getting their best work right then. I like the idea of letting the person who knows the most about it do the talking.
Health Matters Rule Number 6, also posted on the healthcare.gov war room wall. We need to stay focused on the most urgent issues, things that will hurt us in the next 24 to 48 hours. We reported when Superstorm Sandy came through and flooded the University Langone Hospital, W. Craig Fugate, who was the administrator of FEMA at the time, he told them, "You're going to have to deal with FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt." He said, "Don't look at this. Think about what's next." And I think in the same way, when you're in the middle of a disaster, there is a tendency to be overwhelmed. There's a tendency to stop and just look at the disaster. But what they said was, no, we're not worried about who's going to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. We're not worried about that. Let's get through the next 24 hours. What do we need to accomplish?
What you find out is the next, if you're doing that, the 24-hour periods, especially in this case where it drug on from, what, November to February? I mean, yeah. You know, this drug on a long time. So in that scenario, each 24-hour period tends to get easier. And so there at the end, I suspect they were probably having a little bit easier time of it.
Yeah, they actually, many of them had gone home by Christmas.
Yeah.
And then finally, number 7, and they talked about this, there was no scalability in the initial site. That is, they did not test it out with a few users. They just simply opened it up to the entire nation, which was a fundamental flaw in starting it. In the same way, when you're working your way out, if you can test things on a small scale before you put them into the breach on a big scale. And the best example I can give to this is the Apollo 13 movie. People may remember there was actually a model they had on the ground of the equipment that they had up in the Apollo 13 capsule. They tested out solutions on that ground model. It is great to have something running, something with wheels, something with an engine purring that you can test your solutions out before you put them into the breach of a large disaster.
So, Tony, in IT speak, and I'll use UK as an example here, we have a portal that has all of our ERP personnel information in it. In that portal, and it's not in my team, so I'm not the most versed on it, but I do know they have a development environment, a test environment, and a sandbox. Okay, so if you think about a sandbox, we just play in it. Okay, that's where we just lab up whatever, and you can never expect a sandbox to actually work. Okay, but then you have a test. Okay, so now I want to do something to this server. I want to make an update. So then we actually test it on the test, and if it fails, great, we back out, we start over, we figure out, we make it work on test. Then we actually go to dev, which is development, and we actually apply it there and leave it. And then once all that's done, then we've said, okay, now it's time to do it in production. And we actually do it in production. So we've went through 4 levels of system to test this, and the last 2 are at scale. So you're going to do them, or at least they're at a fraction of the scale. They mimic the scaled model. And that's how you can make changes to these large databases for large corporate agencies and maintain a working structure. I mean, because if you think about it, it's just one little bad thing and you'd lose everybody's payroll records. That wouldn't be good.
Nope. So that's our 7 tips for managing a disaster from Health Matters. My apologies to my wife who said, don't beat this thing to death. And yet it seems that we have.
No, you didn't say much. For some reason, believe me, this is a tech topic, and I'm certainly...
Don't you? I mean, there's an excitement about solving a huge problem or about being called in to solve a huge problem. And that's what they said about these guys. They felt that this was their patriotic duty to try to get this site up and running. They sacrificed jobs, salary, and their personal comfort in order to get it running. And it's really, again, Stephen Brill tells it very compellingly in Time Magazine. It's an excellent article, and it also is a lot of food for thought for those of us who do solve problems kind of as a living.
Well, I mean, Tony, let's face it. Some people like to jump out of airplanes. Some people like to climb the side of a mountain. Some people like to go diving. There's all kinds of dangerous things we like to do for adrenaline junkies. Well, some of us just like to get into bad problems and try to fix them. Believe me, I've been doing it all my life. And if you can get into a situation like that and not panic and keep your head there is a sense of reward when you're done that's incredible. And so I'm sure these guys felt like they put out a major fire.
We're going to continue talking about disasters in our third and final fractional portion. We'll bring you some news from Hurricane Katrina and heart attack rates, basically. And we'll also talk about what times it is not good to be cool under fire. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio. Take a break and then stay tuned for our third fractional portion.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Kathleen Sebelius Show.
And boy, is it.
Our salute, our sympathies, and yet our, what would you call it, our unflinching analysis of what happened to Kathleen Sebelius. Again, a very promising, extremely popular two-term governor, very promising on the national scene, mentioned as possible presidential hopeful, who was in the perfect place to launch her career, that is responsible for health care under the Affordable Care Act, which reformed health care, and yet a website, it turns out, was her undoing. And I do not think that the management errors she made in rolling out that website, I do not think are recoverable, to be honest.
No, she's probably ready to ride off into the sunset. Right?
Well, after this, I would think so. I would certainly be disillusioned because I did think by putting her out on the talk shows to talk about the website while someone else was fixing it, she was left without a whole lot of support. And obviously what happened, happened. Our sponsor for the final time, the Tick Fixers and their top six quick tick fixing tricks. Trick number one, avoid tick bites. That's the key thing. That's right. Tuck those pant legs into your socks. It makes you look radiant and attractive to the opposite sex, as well as warding off immature ticks on the ground. Inspect your skin daily and consider using DEET 10 to 35%. Again, 25% DEET provides around 5 hours of protection if you don't sweat too much or don't go swimming. Products with more than 30% DEET should not be used on children. Small children exposed to a large amount of DEET have rarely experienced seizures, so remember that. Also, permethrin, that's Permanone brand. It kills ticks and mites, can be applied to clothes, and will last through several washings. Trick number two, best remove the tick as soon as possible. The risk of disease and transmission increases significantly after 24 hours. Three, use blunt, medium-tip forceps or tweezers. Do not try to tear the tick apart. Grasp as close to the skin as possible. Try to remove as much of the tick as possible. Trick number four, once the tick is removed, wash the bite area with soap and water to destroy any organisms. You can use an antiseptic. You should also wash your hands. Trick number five, routine antibiotics after tick removal, particularly in eastern Kentucky, are not necessary. There needs to be some type of a mitigating circumstance, an unusual rash, a person who is pregnant, or if someone has traveled to an area which is high risk for tick-borne disease. And trick number six, remember the size and color of the tick helps to determine what kind of tick it was. A deer tick is the size of a pencil point, a very tiny thing. The way I am aware of deer ticks biting me is that I have a skin reaction more than actually seeing the tick itself. The size of a pencil eraser, a brown tick with a white collar, that's a dog tick, a brown tick with a white splotch on its back, that's a Lone Star tick, and those can cause a really nasty rash. They tend to be more aggressive in their biting. That's the Tick Fixers and their top six quick tick fixing tricks. Remember, ticks can't compete when you use DEET. Now, we got a couple of other disasters that I wanted to cover in this fractional portion. Start off with an article that was in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings. This was actually last week, the April issue of Mayo Clinic Proceedings.
Great.
They were looking at heart attacks after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. And they looked at almost 1,500 people who had a heart attack before and after Hurricane Katrina. And they came to the Tulane University Health Sciences Center in New Orleans, and they were looking at the characteristics of heart attacks before and after a major disaster like this. Now, compared with the pre-Katrina heart attack, there was a 3 times increase in the percent of admissions for heart attack during the 6 years after Katrina. So one thing, people had more heart attacks. Now, I have a little bit of problem with their data because if you remember, there were a lot of people who exited New Orleans.
Right.
And so I don't know if these are the same people. But if you assume that they are the same people, then these people were traumatized and they had a higher rate of heart attacks. Now, here's an interesting part, I think.
Well, don't you think, Tony, don't you think that life just for like 2 or 3 years might have just been more stressful?
Yeah. I think you go back to your home. If that's the
population. Even if you weren't from there, though. I'm saying even if you weren't there before, moving there. being there during that time may have just been more difficult to function.
The stress of change, the stress of rebuilding, the stress of all those things. I got you.
And probably even people, to some extent, rebuilding probably had some deadlines and time constraints. And, you know, there were probably construction crews that had, you know, signed on to do 5 jobs, and so they did them all as fast as possible. There's probably a whole lot of factors there that could cause that, I would think.
Now, there's something called circadian rhythms, and your body releases a lot of hormones to get you up and going in the morning.
Do they fly around and come out every 17 years?
That's right. You know, what can I do with that, Rick? I'm trying to have a serious conversation. If you're going to say
something funny, there's your problem.
Needs to be funny. I don't know what to do with that. But remember, there are these
You want me to remember something?
Yeah. Heart attacks, we worry a lot about a person who comes in early in the morning with chest pain.
Right.
Those are the most dangerous ones because actually there is a spike in heart attacks early in the morning because of that dawn rise in these stress hormones to get you up and going. That's a very dangerous time. Well, it turns out after Katrina, they had more nighttime and weekend heart attacks, and the heart attack rates decreased in the mornings, on Mondays, and on weekdays. So just the opposite of the pattern they showed. And it may be, again, Rick, if we're talking about stress, it may be that the times you could ruminate on the disaster that has befallen the city, it could be the times when you have some time to think about it, the stress levels go up. But they saw a reversal of the pattern of heart attacks, with fewer heart attacks occurring in the morning, fewer heart attacks on Mondays and on weekdays when we traditionally see a spike, and more heart attacks on nights and weekends. Really, I think, a fascinating change. And, you know, we've talked on this show a lot about how events can influence your health, and particularly your heart health. There were some studies early on that indicated that perhaps after athletic contests, if you won or lost, would make a difference in your rate of heart attack. They were not particularly well done scientifically, but I do know that the ICU nurses at St. Clair would always turn the TV off during the NCAA tournament for their heart patients, worried that they may not be able to tolerate the strain of winning or losing. And so
this would have been, for UK, this would have been a particularly bad year because there was a lot of last second shots.
Right. And you wonder, it would be fairly simple to look at the state data to see if, in fact, we could see a spike after these athletic contests. There has been, again, some more recent work that indicates that's really not so, that the ones that showed an association were bad data. I will say, if you take a team that plays in an unhealthy state like Kentucky, and you have people that live and die by basketball, if ever a sports contest would cause illnesses, particularly heart disease, it should happen in the state of Kentucky. But more so, these disasters that happen, and I wonder about things like, again, Charleston, West Virginia had their water supply contaminated for a period of time, the big mudslide.
You know, right.
These type of disasters, they have a measurable effect on the health of the survivors as well, obviously, as the people who were caught up in that disaster. Next up, and I promised that we would talk about this, when is it not cool to be cool? I like this. This was April 7th in the AMA
Winner?
Journal of Pediatrics. Okay. And the lady's name is Marie-Claude Ouimé from Quebec. Now, first of all, we all know that traffic crashes are a leading cause of death for teenagers.
Right.
Kids get into a lot of problems. And the first few months, the first few years are really dangerous. Now, the other thing you've got to realize is that low cortisol levels, cortisol being a stress hormone, appear to be linked, not necessarily causing, but be linked to risky behavior. Now, let me explain that for a minute. Cortisol is a stress hormone. Let's say you and I, we both go through the same experience, and I have high cortisol levels because I feel a lot of stress. You, meanwhile, have low cortisol levels. You don't feel the stress. Well, that's great. You are a cooler customer than I am.
Right.
However,
glad you noticed.
The problem is you may not be as careful as I am because you don't feel the stress. You see, so having low stress hormone levels turns out to be a marker, something linked with a propensity to engage in risky behavior. If you don't feel stressed, you're willing to take more chances.
I like it.
Okay. So what they did, they took 19 male, 21 female, 16-year-olds who had just gotten their driver's licenses in Roanoke and Blacksburg, Virginia. So you can imagine these kids, they just got their driver's license. Up comes Marie-Claude Ouimé from Quebec. I don't know why she's down there, but she's hanging out at the Department of Motor Vehicles, and she's recruiting these kids. It's a little creepy, but stay with me. They asked the drivers to complete a set of math problems and told them that those who scored the highest would get $60, and they measured the stress hormone, the cortisol levels, in these kids and their saliva as they completed the math problems.
Okay.
So you're in this math competition. You feel a lot of stress because there's $60 on the line. You just got your learner's permit, but who knows what that means? All I know is I got to finish these math problems, and I get higher levels of stress hormone, cortisol, in my saliva. Then, and this is genius, They used cameras and sensors in the vehicles driven by the teenagers to observe their driving behavior, how close they came to having a crash during the next 8 months, and actual crashes. There were 9 near crashes for every crash. Nobody was injured. And they found that these young people who had the highest stress hormone levels, the ones with the highest cortisol levels, had a lower crash and near crash rate than the ones with the low stress hormone levels.
Well, yeah, but what does it do for their heart attacks?
Well,
I mean, because, yeah, okay, maybe they do, their stress causes them to be more careful or to be, you know, more cognizant of what's going on, but it doesn't matter if they're going to die of a heart attack 20 years before me.
Yeah, I understand. The idea, the American mythology is that, you know, you need to be cool under stress, that that is the ideal person. We've talked about this stressful situation there at healthcare.gov. You know that if you can keep your head when others are losing theirs, apparently then you're going to have a wreck.
I'm doomed.
You're a cool customer. You're saying you think that you are a non-stressed guy.
No, it depends on the topic.
I guess you're, that's right, you're doomed. We will accept that regardless of what we're talking about.
No,
you're
it depends on the topic. I mean,
I'll agree with you on that. That's just, you're just doomed. Rick is doomed.
Well, 11 years on this show, that should be obvious, you know. But I guess what I'm saying is when it comes to fixing problems, that was always an area where I could stay relatively calm. And I say relatively because I was calmer than most. You know, it's there's never, you know, when you're working on, especially when I was in the medical side doing all the medical equipment, there's a point in time where you're supposed to be nervous. You know, when you're working on a ventilator that takes care of breathing for a patient, you're supposed to be nervous when you're working on it. You're supposed to be cautious. You're supposed to be careful. So, I mean, I was always better at staying fairly calm in that stuff when the emergencies cropped up.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, if you stay calm, then that means that you're willing to take extra risk. We had.
I haven't been in an exorbitant amount of accidents either, though.
My son had a friend in high school, and this young man's name was Sam. And Sam was an absolute risk taker. He's okay. The kind of guy that he wants to parachute into wildfires. He wants to climb impossible places. He wants to ride on wild bucking broncos. Do all that kind of stuff. I remember we've got a farm. We've got a pond. We had a tree swing that swung out over the pond. And I will never forget this young man basically coming around the tree swing with his ankles basically wrapped in the loop. He was upside down, swinging out on the tree swing. And I thought, this is just idiotic. I mean, he could dash his head against the tree or anything along the bank, but he was that kind of guy. And I think I understand now that he simply did not feel the fear that I would have had in that same situation. And I suspect his cortisol levels were probably rock bottom. Now, this made him a very cool person. I guess the kind of person you would want handling forest fire, handling a disaster that required a cool head. But it means in everyday life, that kind of person, you know, again, it's all situational. In everyday life, he's going to take unnecessary risks because he really doesn't feel that kind of fear and that stress that another person would.
I don't know, Tony. I guess I'm torn a little bit because, you know, is it possible to stay calm and be fearful? That's the thing, is the people that I think can master that have the best of both worlds. Because, I mean, there are times where, like, for instance, yesterday we experienced an outage where I had probably 50% of our call volume wasn't able to succeed. I mean, every contact center in the place was down. I mean, I'm certainly aware of what the impact is. I realize it's very critical. It's mission critical to get it going. But if you're able to stay calm and work the problem, is that both or is that neither? Or is that, how does that fit in?
Right. It's a good question. I will say,
I'm not going to swing. I'm not going to swing upside down on a swing out into the pond.
Right.
So we're different in that respect.
Well, keep in mind, they did not stress these people by asking them to leap from a burning building. They asked them to work math problems. If you're really good at math problems, you probably didn't have much stress at all. But apparently, the other way you could look at it is apparently a good mathematician is a terrible driver.
Well, good point.
So I can interpret this a different way. I think it's interesting, though, there may be, in fact, a marker for risky behavior among kids. And now what we do with that, it's not time yet, but still, you know, I don't know.
Oh, well, it's interesting. I mean, it's great to see where the research is kind of leading in. And obviously, this will have some ramification on, you know, how we deal with it. I think it's interesting. Is there a medication out there short of Valium that can help you deal with stress? Yeah. Can they lower these levels?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Is pharmaceutically,
there a medicine that will make you alert and still care about outcomes?
Correct. I mean,
because the problem is a lot of the things that we do that handle stress just make you not care about the stress, not necessarily able to function better within the stress.
Exactly. So I'm saying research like this will always lead to, you know, either yay or nay or some other spinoff. So, I mean, it's kind of what we do. We talk about this stuff.
One more.
Okay. As long as you do the keep the one up, you got 1 minute.
Right. Not related. Okay. This was, April 9th in the journal Neurology. You know, we've talked about this before. It appears that people with Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and other neurodegenerative diseases have a lower rate of cancer. There is this theory that either you can repair your nervous system, which leads to uncontrolled growth of tissues, which leads to cancer, or you can't, which leads to uncontrolled destruction of tissues, which leads to things like Alzheimer's. The problem is, at least according to researchers from Madrid, Spain, they said the major problem is that maybe if you have Alzheimer's disease, people don't worry about cancer. They don't diagnose cancer because, after all, you have Alzheimer's disease, it won't matter. They looked at 2,600 people in the community, 65 and older, who did not have dementia. They had them take a mini mental state exam. This is a test to look for memory problems, 37 items. They retook it 3 years later, and they divided them up. Some people lost scores rapidly, some people maintained, and some people actually got better on their second take. If you look at those who had the fastest decline in their test scores, after 13 years, cancer was significantly less in those people. It was 20% of those had cancer versus nearly 30% in the ones who had the lowest rate of change of their test scores. They concluded, after looking at the data, controlling for other things like smoking and diabetes and things that might affect your risk of cancer, that people who had a higher cognitive decline, even if they didn't yet have Alzheimer's disease, they were 30% less likely to die of cancer. So this theory still holds, Rick, that cancer seems to protect against Alzheimer's disease, or Alzheimer's disease protects against cancer. There appears to be two ways your body can respond to stress, either with destruction of tissue, Alzheimer's disease, or with proliferation, which leads to cancer, but they don't seem to follow the same pathway. Fascinating research, and another article bears this out. Can you get us out of here?
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producers Asa Hosoda and Spencer Johnson, to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org, or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember,
Health Matters is a health radio show for adult males who have no or low testosterone.
It is not known if Health Matters is safe or effective in children younger than 18 years old. Radio shows that are applied to the skin may have different doses, strengths, or an application instructions that may lead to different levels of testosterone in your body.
Health Matters can transfer from your body to others. This can happen if other people come into contact with the area where Health Matters was heard.
Unexpected signs of puberty, hate when that happens, have happened in young children who were accidentally exposed to radio shows through skin-to-skin contact with men using health radio products like Health Matters.
Women and children should avoid contact with the unwashed or unclothed area where Health Matters was heard. If a woman or child makes contact with the Health Matters application area, the contact area on the woman or child should be washed well with soap and water right away.
That's right. Wash that Health Matters right off your child as soon as you can. But whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.